Welcome to Crown and Crozier, the podcast on church, state, and faithful citizenship. I'm your host, Patrick Brown. The church teaches us that the well-being of individuals and society is bound up with a healthy state of conjugal and family life. Marriage is a partnership of the whole of life, ordered towards the good of the spouses and the procreation and education of offspring. The family, meanwhile, is the laboratory of love and fundamental building block of society. But what's the state of marriage and the family these days? Is public policy effectively safeguarding these institutions? When it comes to things like government action on childcare, is the work of the home even being properly valued? Joining us to tackle these questions is Andrea Morozik, Senior Fellow at Cardis Family. Cardis Family is an initiative of the Christian think tank Cardis, based in Canada, and dedicated to strengthening the ways in which society's institutions can work together for the common good. Andrea was previously Executive Director of the Institute of Marriage and Family Canada and is widely recognized as a leading voice in Canada on marriage, childcare, and women's issues. Don't forget to subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts, follow us on Twitter or Facebook, or leave us a rating.
There are two swords, and the question is, which sword is superior, the spiritual sword or the temporal sword?
And without God, democracy will not and cannot long endure.
I die His Majesty's good servant at God's first.
Andrea Morozik, welcome to Crown and Crozier.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
For this episode, you could say we are bringing it home, or we're bringing the conversation to the home, talking about important issues related to the family, children, marriage. Couldn't be more thrilled to have the expertise you and your colleagues at Cardis have to offer. So why don't we start there? I know recently Cardis updated its best-in-class database on marriage and the family, the most recent trends in Canadian society. Perhaps you could touch on some of the high points from that recent update.
Yeah, so Cardis puts out a marriage map, and that comes from the census collection of data. So we can update that every 5 years as the census data is released, which happened this year. Very exciting. So trend lines in marriage and family through that census show us a little bit of what we have been seeing, which is that married families are still a majority at 65% of families, but it is declining over the years. So for context, it used to be 83% of families were married parent families in 1981, and today we're at 65%. The growth of common law is a point of discussion, and that comes largely through Quebec. And lone parent families have also been increasing, although they are quite stable now between the last census and this census. So that's kind of the big picture. There's a lot of cultural trends on marriage. We think at Cardis, marriage is really important. That's why we do this marriage map, so-called, and put up all the data with good graphs and show you what that census data is showing in clear terms. We always struggle a bit with it's declining versus it is still the majority family form, something we can be happy about. So is there a call to despair? No. But is it as good as it could be? Also, no. So those are some of the bigger picture items there.
Yeah, and lots to unravel. Maybe we'll start with, well, the first question, the percentage of married couples in the ecosystem and universe of families in Canada has declined, as you said. Why? Why do you folks think that is?
Yeah, so the corollary to that is that we have an increase in single person households, I think is how the census terms it. So a household of one basically is on the rise. And then you're asking why that is. I guess there's a lot that can be said there. We have delayed marriage. We have a tougher entry point into marriage. We have population of people who by and large view marriage as nice, but not necessary. So if we have delayed marriage, and we do, the age of first marriage is definitely getting older and older, then we're going to see fewer families forming. Marriage is still today correlated with fertility. A lot of people will live together for a very long time, but wait until they're married to have children. That's still true today. Sounds quite quaintly conservative or traditional, but that still remains a fact. So why we have single person households is probably the trajectory of how we've seen family life unfold. Marriage has changed from being an institution that was important to start your life and has become something that is a nice to have, but certainly not necessary. Something that people do when a lot of other factors and a lot of other boxes have already been checked, be it career development or finishing really lengthy degrees, this kind of thing.
Is there anything from the data or perhaps any accompanying analysis that you folks conduct, which indicates that for a lot of folks, maybe for an increasing number of folks, there's a sense that there are too many barriers or disincentives? Perhaps they think it's too costly, or there's not enough support, whether it's through society at large or public policy. Does any of that come across in your database or your analysis?
For marriage, we haven't asked the polling questions as recently why Canadians would say, you know, marriage is nice to have but necessary. I'm trying to think back. The last time we polled would probably be 2016. And definitely you get that sense of diminishing importance of marriage. But unpacking whether that's, you know, part of policy benefits that aren't present, my sense is that's not part of the picture for Canadians. I don't know about you, Patrick, but I'm not necessarily making my relationship decisions based on what the federal or provincial government is offering me. Although we do take time to make sure or try to think about whether there's marriage penalties in policy. One thing that's interesting in the marriage trend lines is that people who are wealthier are getting married more than people who are lower income. And so you see a bit of a class, an emerging class divide on marriage. And I think that's something that Canadian policymakers and researchers and academics don't really discuss enough. We have a pretty pervasive inequality discussion in Canada, but family structure doesn't tend to figure into that as much as we think it should at CARDIS. That's something you see in developed nations, the United States for sure, and Canada isn't an exception.
Let's maybe go into that a little bit more. I mean, if there's data to suggest that the wealthy or the wealthier among us are more likely to get married, what are some solutions or prescriptions that come to mind? Or is it in part trying to tackle or mitigate kind of the perception that you have to have means in order to enter into this particular institution?
Yeah, I'm not really sure. First of all, there's often a bit of a divide that many of these wealthier people will talk a progressive line, but act very conservatively. So one thing that would be great would be to have a more robust discussion and just have honesty flowing around the idea of, you know, you may say you support, using the catchphrases of the day, the diversity of family forms or what have you. But if you're living very traditionally, perhaps it would be a step in the right direction if we're acknowledging that. I think there's not a ton of information out there on the benefits of marriage. So as we talk about these statistics, we haven't really talked about why it matters. Marriage should not be a luxury good. It shouldn't be something that comes to the wealthy or something that comes only later in life. But I don't think people realize, for example, that there's a vast difference in the research between cohabitation and marriage. I think most Canadians might think those are parallel things, that living together is roughly the same as marriage. And the research doesn't really bear that out. It's not up to me to convince people to get married. It's not for everyone, but that it is a venerable institution, that it confers benefits on people, that we see financial wealth accrue, that we definitely see benefits for children in marriage. This type of research it should be more accessible to mainstream or normal people. And we should have more of an elite agreement, I think, on the fact that marriage does matter. And that it's different from, for example, living common law. You know, nobody's going to claim that lone parenting is the same as being married when you're raising kids. But the common law marriage comparison, I think, needs to be fleshed out a little bit more for people so that they understand that it's not the same.
Let's dive a little bit deeper into that. And just as an aside, your earlier comment about progressive celebrities championing the benefits of different family structures, but themselves practicing one singular form. I remember coming across an article profiling the likes of our counterparts south of the border, you know, Vice President Kamala Harris, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Nancy Pelosi, some of the high-profile figures on the Democratic side in the lawmaking circles. And there was a litany of examples along those lines where each, without exception, each and every one of them had either pursued, was pursuing, or had been in a long time marriage, and their simple witness and practical example belying many of the the perspectives that they would otherwise share in their public statements. So I would certainly echo that strongly. But let's dive a little bit deeper into the qualitative differences between marriage and common law unions. What does your data, what does your analysis bear out in that regard in terms of emphasizing the distinct differences between the two and the differences in benefits or purported benefits?
So I think the first thing that jumps to mind in answering that question is that common law, even in places where it looks more stable, is less stable than marriage. What I'm saying is it breaks up more often. And that may intuitively make sense, but it is a massive difference between marriage and common law. So if common law is more likely to break up, that can fit into the picture of delayed marriage. So if you live with someone for 5 years at the prime of life, and maybe for women when you are most likely to be able to have kids, then you can imagine how that changes your life course down the road. Married people are also more likely to share resources and share their finances, share bank accounts. I think there is still ultimately a picture of marriage as being the more permanent thing. There's the idea in common law that happens. I think we all have our friends and family for whom this has happened. People slide into common law. It's not an overt decision-making process. It happens piecemeal. A toothbrush gets moved over and another piece of clothing. And then you end up living together without any concrete decision. So that speaks, I think, to the longevity as well. If you haven't actually intended to form a lifelong partnership, then maybe you won't, right? But ultimately, I think that the biggest difference to me lies in how stable these relationships are. And there's even some research, I think, showing that if you're living together, parents interact differently with their kids versus married parents. I think oftentimes when we think about this research, which is, you know, kind of dry and academic, we always have in our own lives the families we know who have lived together or have split, and watching how step families interact with their kids is markedly different than, for example, two-parent married families. So yeah, sometimes I find it interesting to just see how the research bears itself out in my personal life with friends and family, right? Which actually leads to something that I feel is really important to state. CARDIS is a Christian think tank. We do look at the family data. We don't look at it with an eye to judgment. We don't look at it with an eye to married as better or looking down on people who don't live out certain family forms. But at the same time, we're not shy to say we think that particularly for children, marriage is a more stable family form. That's kind of a factual statement more than it is an ideological one or, God forbid, a judgmental one. But certainly I come to this issue of looking at the family and supporting family and marriage from the standpoint of wanting to decrease the pain that I've seen in my own life via the divorces of family and friends.
In this conversation, we addressed, well, okay, these are the changes in the data. These are the trend lines. Why is that? And I think you've just really eloquently articulated the companion question to that is, why should we care?
Yeah. And when I think about, say, for example, the fact that marriage is becoming a luxury good, a luxury item, right? That's a term that's been used. It's an issue of ameliorating poverty too, right? And if you think about what it means to live in a solo person household, probably loneliness is a factor, right? So creating communities that work for everyone is part and parcel of why I do this work. And marriage is this foundational building block that we, I guess, either from our wealth or just ignorance or, you know, the sexual revolution has taken us into crazy places with regards to ethics and morals around family life. But we are taking families for granted in a way that concerns me. It's worth talking about that in something other than a perfunctory way, and certainly not in the way that political people do every 4 years at an election time, and throwing money in various directions, trying to win votes. Like, that's not where it's at for me either. We need a basic foundational idea of the importance of marriage and family. And then, you know what? People can also choose to live how they want if we understand the importance of those basics.
Yeah, and I'm going to guess, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but in light of all of these updates to the data, the database that you folks manage, and the census data from the government of Canada, my sense is what marriage is, what purpose it serves, its greater function, my guess is that only gets reinforced the more data comes out through these types of cyclical updates. Nothing in what you've just shared I think, diminishes what we came to this conversation beforehand, likely with our understanding of the importance and the role of marriage, and trying to continuously wrap our heads around, you know, what is marriage for? And it seems very clear that in the latest data, the best empirical analysis we have out there, it only reinforces that underlying proposition. Is that fair?
Yeah, it reinforces it, but it does also, like when we look at Statistics Canada, for example, on that idea of taking marriage for granted, between 2008 and basically right now, Statistics Canada stopped collecting marriage and divorce statistics, sort of those basic building block data points. And so Cartus, of course, my think tank that I work for, noticed this, and we did a letter, and much to my pleasant surprise, a range of academics all across the spectrum of thinking all signed a letter saying we need these data points, right? But in that sort of sphere of taking these things for granted, StatsCan hadn't thought they needed to continue to collect marriage and divorce data in the roster of things that they collect. So they're changing that now. We'll call it a success for our group and others who clamored for this data to reemerge. But to me, it was slightly shocking that they would even think of dropping that in an era where a lot of things get measured, right? So, you know, we have this data from census data, but every 5 years isn't the same thing as collecting it and putting in a database annually at a federal place where everyone can access it, right? So this both shows how we neglect marriage and the basics of this data, family data points. And then it's a happy story because I think they're returning, I think, to collecting marriage and divorce data soon.
I mean, it reminds me of the old adage we hear a lot in the business world: what matters gets measured. It sends a powerful signal from our state authorities if they don't think marriage and family matters enough to measure. I am curious, and this might be a bit more relevant and direct to our Canadian listeners, but certainly for listeners in the United States and elsewhere, for whom their jurisdictions have more recently redefined marriage. I mean, same-sex marriage was legalized in Canada in 2004. And that redefinition, that re-understanding of marriage, I'm curious, does that come across in Canada's marriage database? And are there any trend lines or any observations of note in that regard?
No, I guess it's under 1% or roughly 1% of couples who are same-sex couples. In Canada, that's more same-sex couples living together versus getting married.
For same-sex couples, what are the numbers?
1% of couples are same-sex couples, 1%. And that encompasses both living together and married. 0.7% of same-sex couples are living common law, and then 0.3% are married. It still remains, and even in Canada, where we legalized same-sex marriage in earlier, it still remains quite new. And I think on that note, with the census, I really don't envy the people designing the questions. There's a complexity to the recent terminology in census data collection on family that I didn't see in the 2016 census, for example. So they've introduced terms about cisgender and transgender and non-binary and trying to find out about all these different diversity of family forms, which I'm not against collecting the data. I just would like for our public policy to focus on the vast majority rather than the 0.1 or, you know, 0.2% of non-binary or trans couples. And this is something that's become so complex that I certainly don't envy those people trying to collect the data. Like, the terminology is getting unwieldy.
Yeah, no, that's totally understandable. Does anything come across from your database around the role of faith or religious practices or rituals in a marriage, and whether or not that perhaps is a characteristic of, I'll say, more successful marriages or marriages with more longevity?
So the marriage map reflects the census data, and then the census is not asking about religiosity and marriage. So we don't have that up there, but we do know from research that faith correlates with marriage, and married people are more likely to get, faithful people are more likely to get married. So there's a correlation there that's worth unpacking. And certainly on this podcast, the connection between religiosity and marriage is pretty clear. The other point which that comes up as a, you know, point of interest in the data is on the declining divorce rate. So we do have a declining divorce rate for various reasons, but one of them might be around who's choosing to get married. If it's in greater proportion a largely religious population, then they might have more tendency to stay together. So sort of a self-selection bias there. But mostly I think the declining divorce rate is actually around fewer young people getting married and living together instead. And then the demise of their cohabiting relationships doesn't register in the divorce statistics. But to return to your earlier question, yes, faith does play a role in all this, but it's not necessarily reflected in the marriage map because we are giving you the data that the census collects.
Right. Particularly in a Canadian context, there's been a lot of action recently between federal and provincial governments here in Canada on the topic of childcare and different milestones, some would say different breakthroughs achieved as it relates to funding agreements between the federal government and the provincial government for the provision of childcare, greater access to childcare, greater access to higher quality childcare. I want to get your thoughts on this. I know Cardis has spilled a lot of ink talking about these recent agreements and potential benefits, potential drawbacks. Maybe they're not all they're cracked up to be. Perhaps maybe just give us a quick survey synopsis of these recent agreements, where things stand and kind of what they mean.
Sure. So the childcare agreements that were recently signed by all 10 provinces and 3 territories have amounted to what we could loosely term national daycare, a step toward that. So you have many activists on that side very much cheering and what they see as the advance of childcare policy in Canada towards something of a system. The federal budget allocated something around $30 billion toward building this and an ongoing funding amount, which is lower but still high. I think it might be around $9 billion annually for the continuation of this so-called system. Why I say so-called system is because we have every bit of evidence right now that it's not advancing, that it will be something of a tortured journey if we ever get toward a system. And I like to quote the advocates for the system on this. There's an economist named Gordon Cleveland who has tracked with the issue of childcare in Canada over decades now. And he recently put out a paper with IRPP, Institute for Research and Public Policy. And in it, he says that Canada is on track to become like Quebec. And that is not a success story, I don't think in his estimation or in mine. So in Quebec, that is the one province that always for 20 years now has had a provincial system. And so what we see there in a nutshell is lower quality of care for children, poor outcomes for children, and ultimately a lack of access to childcare. So John Iveson, National Post columnist, apparently has small children in Quebec and wrote about the lack of access as we progress towards this so-called national daycare system. Talked about how in Quebec, he didn't have any expectation that he would be getting a spot near or far. So when people who advocate for this type of development point out that we're headed in Quebec's direction, and it is important for your listeners to know that that is not a success. It's not a slam dunk. It's, yeah, definitely going to be a very tricky process.
Yeah, I mean, living here in Ottawa, different social interactions you have, you often hear from folks who live across the proverbial river, or the actual river, the Ottawa River, they talk on the other side, depending on the circles you're in, there can be excited references to the $8 a day daycare on the other side of the river in Quebec. But you're saying it's not all it's cracked up to be. Can you just provide a little bit more detail? I mean, you've spoken around suboptimal outcomes and lack of access. Just perhaps provide a bit more color there.
So I think the stat is that only a third of kids have access to the system in Quebec, 30% roughly. And so that speaks volumes after spending billions of dollars in that province to the unworkability of that type of system. The desire of the activists for national daycare is to eradicate private care and to have all care forms be not for profit. That is what happened in Quebec. It was a major problem. Private or for-profit daycares were pushed out, and then you saw this complete lack of access and the wait lists, etc. The Quebec government eventually had to coax those private providers back in through tax incentives, and they did that. That's happening and playing out in the rest of Canada now too, right? So you see the animosity towards private care or so-called profit care. There aren't really any big box providers that I'm aware of, so-called, that would be terrible. The vision of like the worst of institutional care in Canada. For profit in Canada usually means a local entrepreneur has some spaces for the community there. Those are being eradicated as we speak. out of animosity towards the idea of private care. We think of childcare as the care of a child, no matter who does it. I have a three-year-old and was incidentally looking for care very recently. I have my own story about no presence of cheaper childcare in my community. But yeah, the other thing you raised is the question of quality in Quebec. And so there's been a couple of peer-reviewed studies that have been replicated showing poor outcomes in Quebec for children. So lower social development scores, poorer outcomes on things like aggression, the sorts of things that economists can measure and scale. So I don't view that as something we can dismiss out of hand. It's important. And the whys and hows of how that's come about is important. And finally, something I hope we do talk about is the nature of what a daycare provision does when it's preferentially funded by the government to families. So I feel like that's an important playing field and something to consider. Are we funding families or are we funding institutions that circumvent the family? And those are two distinct ways of helping families. And I decidedly prefer giving the money to the families themselves and letting them decide what they want to do with it.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that. That certainly was one of the top of mind angles I wanted to tackle this issue from. The cynic in me, and maybe it's not unfair to say it's cynicism, but you look at the arrangements which have been brokered, and particularly for the benefit of our non-Canadian listeners, it's not putting too fine a point on it to say this has been heralded with much fanfare in the policy and media circles. It does seem at first glance, and not with a lot of probing that needs to be done, it seems quite apparent, even at a surface level, that this is where it's a bit unclear to me, is it a feature or a bug of this system that this is now channeling all energy and resources into state-sponsored care? And I'm gleaning from you that, no, that's not by accident. This is kind of by design. This is kind of funneling and channeling resources and structures and systems all in the direction of state-sponsored care. And I can't help but think that that will have profound implications down the road.
Yeah, I think that it's not cynical to view it as a feature. There's a lot of points I could make around pointing to the sort of circumventing parental authority in these systems as being a feature and not a bug. First of all, in family, Canada has funded families for over 100 years. It's not something new to talk about funding families. We've done that in various different forms over the years. But money to parents is a dramatically different way of funding families than money to centers. And that's kind of the divide, right? So at Cardis, there would be differing views on this alone, but we have never been opposed to money to parents. It's the money to the centers, to the spaces that parents never see that we're opposed to. So if I look at my own situation, I'm never going to benefit a lick from the new national daycare agreements because I don't choose to use licensed center-based care, which is virtually the only kind of care that's funded. And, you know, it would be too cynical, I think, to say that activists for national daycare don't care about parents. They do. But to varying degrees in their worldview, do they trust parents? And so I trust parents to make a decision. I want parents to be able to navigate the landscape of childcare choices in their communities and decide what works for them the best, whether it be themselves caring, juggling care with a parent, family, friends, what have you. I trust parents to be able to make those decisions. I don't think that is necessarily widespread on the opposing side of, you know, this debate. And ultimately, when we fund spaces, we know already right now, a lot of those spaces that are funded are going to sit empty. They'll still get the funding. And then lower income parents who could probably benefit from a couple of hundred extra dollars a month will not benefit from that. So I get kind of down when I think about the billions being spent and for what? So spaces do sit empty. Like we used to measure at Cardis the vacancy rates, and we did that in the Toronto area and we did it in British Columbia. I don't think they make that data readily available anymore, but at the time there were vacancy rates that were surprising and they were high. And that has to do with the fact, I think, that you can have surplus of spaces and still have people not able to find the childcare that they want. because it's a very local issue. When you're looking for childcare, if you live in Toronto and you're in Etobicoke, you can't access a space in Scarborough. That's not helpful to you. That might as well not be there, right? So there's a lot of different, it's complex. The issue is very complex. And my money is not on the federal government building a daycare system that works for the local communities where parents are actually parenting and working and doing life.
Taking that a bit further, it also seems to me that one of the profound implications in all this is the signal that the government is sending is what is being funded here. Not only are we crowding out other players who could provide a similar type of service, but this type of service, this type of care gets preferential treatment. And all alternatives, those become afterthoughts, and those become distant seconds in terms of the preferential ladder. And that could even include, in terms of distant seconds, a child or children being home with their parents, and that being a quote unquote preferred form of care. I mean, it seems like an implication of these types of arrangements is the model of children being at home with their parents in early years or later years or what have you, that becomes less preferential. Do you think that's too strong of a conclusion?
No, I'm not sure when this started. Like, my daughter's only three, right? But certainly any parent on the playground knows the question of, like, what daycare is she in? Not, is she in daycare? And this started to happen when she was really, really young, right? So policy does, I think, to a certain extent, create habits. 10 years ago in Ontario, roughly speaking, we introduced full-day kindergarten. Prior to that point, a sort of cultural norm was half-day kindergarten, and a lot of parents chose that, sanctioned it. And then when they funded and created the full-day kindergarten, then that became the preferential choice. It definitely is a way of the government saying this is better. We have chosen and we are funding this particular option versus the more laissez-faire idea of giving money to a family and letting them decide. But I certainly do feel, just on a personal level, the pressure of, well, where are you taking your kids? What are you doing with them? At 2 years of age, my daughter, a really friendly mom in the park, was like, oh, she's not in daycare, so you're homeschooling. I'm like, no, she's two. We're living life. We're doing our thing. I work part-time. I didn't get into all these details with her, right? But I'm like, just because my daughter is not in daycare at two does not mean I'm a homeschooling mom. Not that I have a problem with that. But do you see my point? Sort of like, everyone's doing the daycare thing. If you're not, you must be, you know, on the homeschooling track. I think there's no way around the fact that government policy dictates. On that note, there's all kinds of family policies. So we're talking childcare, but that partners with parental leave. Maternity leave was up until very recently a year. That also dictated a certain choice amongst mothers that you stay home for the year, then you return to work. And I'm just sort of neutrally describing the Canadian reality, which is quite generous in contrast with the United States, but it does dictate the way people act. So the flexibility that you actually do need with children to be able to assess, is my child ready at 1 year to do X or Y? It's not, the flexibility and the choice is not as great as we might be led to believe, because when you set up your life to return to work after a 1 year mat leave, you might be financially wrapped in. There's a cultural expectation around it. The government's not going to give you more benefits after that. And ultimately, your one-year-old isn't independent. So these are sorts of things that I think family policy struggles mightily with. It is very tricky. And I see the United States debating and discussing, you know, parental leave right now. And they have every reason to hash it out and get it right. I happen to be in favor of parental leave benefits, even long ones, especially when contrasted with center-based care for really young children. My heart kind of aches when I hear about 8 weeks leave. So, but the reality is that it's not wrong for the United States to be debating this endlessly to get it right, because it has implications, vast implications, for how people will choose to live after that policy comes down.
I'm going to play devil's advocate here, and admittedly may end up talking out of both sides of my mouth. But if we take the course of action where, in lieu of centers being funded for childcare purposes and those resources being directed or redirected to families or parents directly, is there a risk of increased dependence on the government or on the state for that type of, for those dollars and that support?
Yeah, there is that risk. And that's why I'm saying the United States, as they talk this through, need to be, we never want to have a situation where families can only form if they get a grant or monies coming in from the government. So there is also, though, a continuum of options available. And the SIP, that I personally believe that the ship has sailed for no benefits to families. You know, in a Burkean worldview, you'd have your little platoons and the families would be independent, and you might have them, you know, being thoroughly independent from government. It's not the world we live in, is all I'm trying to say. And specifically in Canada, in Ottawa, where I live, we have a vast array of benefits. And so there's a continuum of options, what might be better or worse. And when faced with a massive system and billions of dollars being, frankly, in my view, wasted on a system that won't function the way parents have been told it will, then I'd prefer that parents get the money. But I also see your point around deciding what that amount is and who do we help, and do we do targeted benefits versus universal benefits. Just by the by, one of the things we're already seeing in childcare policy in Canada is that wealthier families are getting more benefits out of it because it's not targeted. It is a universal program, or so-called. It's trying to be universal. So when we give money to everyone, eventually money gets taken away from those who would need it most, we'd all agree would need it most. So you have sort of perverse incentives built into a national daycare program whereby middle-class families who could otherwise pay for care are getting money and poorer families are not. And this is the kind of complexity around family policy. Somebody I read recently suggested that, like, foreign policy is a walk in the park when you contrast with the complexity and the difficulty of getting family policy right, domestic policies like that. So that might give some context for listeners, because I don't think foreign policy is all that easy either.
There's a lot of truth to that. I mean, the counterpoint to my own devil's advocate question around the risk of increased dependence on the state for grants or support. I mean, the alternative perspective to that is, I mean, that's taxpayer dollars being recycled and refunded to taxpayers directly. I would argue that can only be a good thing when more of your tax dollars are being recycled to you for you as the payer or the parent to use as you see fit. I think that's a principle worth supporting.
Yes, indeed. And then there's different ways, you know, if we're going to talk about us getting our own money back via a tax refund or credit, like the Canada Child Benefit comes into my mailbox monthly. But I know that in Hungary, if you have four children, the family doesn't pay any taxes ever again, right? So that's an extreme example of a country that has done an all-out assault on family policy and wants to create families and fund families in every possible way and in ways that I'm uncomfortable with. But, you know, what would it look like in Canada to have a family with kids not paying taxes, right? Not getting your money back, just never giving it away in the first place, right? I don't know that we have the political will to try that, but there are a number of different ways to get at support for families and ensuring that we recognize the benefits of families and having kids. We do have to decide that that matters, though, first, before we discuss the policy.
Sure. I will confess, I did just get a little giddy there at the description of families with four kids and more never having to pay tax again. you've got my attention. That's intriguing. I want to switch gears here a little bit. We've spoken a little bit about this in some of our past episodes. We did an episode, for example, looking at the intellectual architecture of feminism and the political philosophy of Mary Wollstonecraft, who's considered to be the godmother of feminism. And one of the principles from her writing and her school of thought was for the work of the home to be valued more than the marketplace, than the work that's done in the marketplace. And I really get the sense that that principle is very much at play in these discussions. I would argue that in the types of arrangements we've seen, the federal and the provincial governments here in Canada brokering these childcare funding protocols, I don't get the sense that that principle, the work of the home is more valuable than the work in the market, I don't get the sense that that principle is animating these agreements. And if we're looking at fixes or solutions or prescriptions, it seems like reverting back to some of these fundamental principles is perhaps where we start and perhaps where we end. Do you agree with that sentiment? Do you feel like these childcare funding agreements are taking guidance, taking cues from the principle of the work of the home being more valuable than the work of the market? Or do you feel like it's actually the inverse at play?
No, it's the inverse. We don't value the work of the home. We don't actually think of it as work, frankly, in many ways. And there is actually bringing up, I'm sure you might, maybe you're talking, you had Erica Bakayoki on your podcast with her new book on Mary Wollstonecraft.
She would be the one.
It's an excellent book and it's an excellent look at a more robust feminism. So undergirding a lot of our direction in particularly childcare, but other places as well, is this what I'd call a misbegotten feminism. This idea that, and maybe 50 years ago when advocacy for national daycare first started, certainly it was a different landscape in Canada at that time. The percentage of women working was different in the workforce. By that, I mean, in the workforce, I think women work in the home and work in the workforce just the same. But the idea of feminism back 50 years ago was really pushing women out of the home and into waged work. And there was a lower participation rate amongst mothers at that time. And so this, I think, misbegotten feminism partnered with the desire of the growing desire at a federal level to accrue more taxes and get more people out into the labor force. So I guess is a meandering way of saying we don't really value home work per se. And then other thing that I like to talk about is that family desires in policy are different than government desires. So a one-year maternity leave, generous as it is, welcome to me as it is also a way of attaching you to the labor force so that you definitely do return. You landscape your life out and say, I get this 1 year and then I'm going back, right? It curtails your maternal choices in a sense, should you decide that that's not for you, as I did. Now it happens, we extended our leave to 18 months. So I grabbed hold of that and took it, albeit without pay, but it still is very generous to be able to do that. But anyways, what I'm getting at is the idea that governments have a different intention in policy than families do. And getting you to work isn't necessarily the same thing as helping your family. And if we're going to talk about feminism, I'm completely opposed to the idea that today we need to have coercive incentives to getting mothers of young children into the workforce. It's not the world we live in. There's a lot of freedom of choice for women working. And if there was ever a need to sort of push on that lever, it certainly isn't today. So like freedom of choice should extend to mothers of young children being able to be with their kids if that's what they desire to do. And that's not always as accessible in government policy, not always culturally sanctioned either. You get, I think a stay-at-home mom so-called would get a lot of flack for what they do. What do you do? As if it were negligible.
Sure.
I remain hopeful based on reading books by Erica Bakayoki and others like her. There's just been a plethora of books recently. I would point to also, here it is on my shelf, The Case Against the Sexual Revolution by Louise Perry, who is a self-described feminist in the UK, talking about the limitations of feminism and sexual revolution as it partnered with feminism. I should say it's not the limitations of a feminism well thought out. It's the limitations of the sexual revolution and the sexual libertine lifestyle as it came to be partnered with feminism.
In the aftermath of the U.S. Supreme Court's decision on Dobbs reversing Roe versus Wade, what doors does that open? I mean, it certainly seems to have ignited various fires, figuratively speaking. What opportunities do you see in the wake of that decision for advancing your message and furthering your advocacy?
Well, in the United States, I think that a lot of good conversation has come out about after Roe was overturned around the nature of family and how to support families and how to support women such that they can have children and be able to make real choices. So Roe obviously being overturned doesn't mean that nobody's ever going to have an abortion again. But I think the conversation has turned in greater portions toward a meaningful choice, such that if you are having an abortion because you have financial need or other things that can actually be rectified, let it be that we have both civil society actors, families, and government policies in place that support your ability to have a family. why not have policy leaning in that direction? Whereas prior to, I would think we're turning a bit more in that direction, especially given that fertility rates are quite bleak and waning. But prior to this point, we've had a lot of policies that actually made abortion into an easier choice that it ought never have been, right? So long gone are the days of Hillary Rodham Clinton saying that abortion should be safe, legal, and rare. And myself as a pro-lifer, far be it from me to say that that's the perfect ideal, but gosh, is it not so much better than what we have now, which is a pervasive abortion culture. And in Canada, anyways, the availability of abortion at any time throughout a pregnancy. I think there's opportunities now, long story short, to have conversations about family supportive policies that help women to make the choices they'd like to make to keep a child, should that be what is desired and wanted by that particular woman. And that's a step in the right direction for sure.
Where can people go to learn more about your organization?
CARDIS as a think tank is at CARDIS.ca. So lots more there on top of family statistics, but the family statistics are there also in the marriage map as well.
Wonderful. Well, Andrea, we're going to leave it there. Thank you so much for your time today. Thank you for all of your contributions to helping to foster a society where we do value the work of the home even more than the work of the market, believe it or not. We really appreciate your insights and time today.
Well, thanks for having me. It's a good conversation to have.
Thanks for tuning in. If you like what you heard, don't forget to subscribe to our show wherever you get your podcasts, and help us to reach more listeners by leaving us a rating or referring us to a friend. If you'd like to partner with us in the delivery of this podcast, head on over to our website at crownandcrozier.com and click the heart button in the top right-hand corner to learn more about making a one-time or monthly donation. We're sincerely grateful for you listening in, and we look forward to providing you with future episodes on church, state, and faithful citizenship. Until then, God bless.